From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. The city of Miami Beach remains under an emergency curfew after college students flocked to the streets and beaches for spring break. Many didn't observe social distancing or wear masks, and police cracked down hard. They used SWAT teams and pepper balls to break up crowds over the weekend. For more, we're joined by Veronica Zaragovia of member station WLRN in Miami. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. And so the city imposed an 8 p.m. curfew on Saturday, and hours later, police enforced that curfew by firing pepper balls into crowds of tourists. How were residents of Miami Beach responding to this use of force?
I think residents here in Miami Beach who I've spoken to have said that what they welcome are measures like the curfew and limiting cars or pedestrians or restaurants from operating after certain hours. People feel uneasy about the use of force. I don't think anybody would be happy that things have escalated the way they have. And they would prefer that this curfew could avoid another incident like what has transpired here in the last few days.
Sure. And one other layer, of course, is that many of the tourists were Black, and critics say that's one of the reasons why police reacted the way they did. I know you've spoken with the Miami Beach Black Affairs Committee, Veronica. So what do they have to say about that?
That's right. I spoke with Gregory Branch. He's the vice chair of this committee that he says was put together in part to raise awareness of the contributions of Black residents to Miami Beach. And he has some mixed feelings. He feels like there should be a fight among Black people to get more events here in Miami Beach that they are interested in, that don't just cater to the art collectors who come down for Art Basel, for instance. You know, how about events that bring in people who live in this area? And he said that the fighting that he saw over the weekend, he does not support. He's making a call for people to obey the rules. He's worried that these images that are spreading on social media are only going to yield more racism.
Okay. And I know you're talking to some of the spring breakers as well. Let's hear from one of them. This is Christina Thomas, who is Black. And here she is talking about the police crackdown.
It was a mess. But I mean, I didn't think that it called for all that, because really everybody was just having a good time. Like, they weren't breaking into things. They weren't like fighting or anything like that. So that was kind of a bummer.
So, Veronica, I mean, is what we hear from Christina there kind of typical for what you're hearing more broadly from the tourists who are visiting Miami Beach?
You know, I heard, I mean, a lot of that, I spoke to many Black tourists as well as non-Black tourists, and people generally understood the need for the curfew and kind of understood that there was a need for police officers. Even Christina Thomas told me that police officers had been cordial. She asked if she left the area, could she maybe come back? Would she have troubles coming back? And she said that she got a help from the police officer. But, you know, people are also disappointed because they feel like they paid money to come down here. And a lot of them say, well, we want to go to Fort Lauderdale where there isn't a curfew, but an Uber could cost $200, one spring breaker told me. And then they're not sure. It could take, there were reports of traffic lasting about 2 hours to get back into Miami Beach. And so it was unexpected. And I think that was unfortunate for visitors who wanted to enjoy their time here.
In the moments we have left, Veronica, I want to ask you about this other complicating dynamic, which is that the governor of Florida has said the state's open for business, come on down. But then you have mayors, like in Miami Beach, saying they're concerned about large gatherings. So how is that mixed messaging factoring into what we're seeing right now?
Yes, I mean, even locals who live here, who I've spoken to, have said that he should come down here on a Friday night and see what it's like, that this image of Florida's open. I mean, students did tell me they chose to come down to Florida because states like California had more restrictions. And so people are feeling like they don't have any support. I mean, the governor, Ron DeSantis, has taken away the possibility for local governments to fine businesses or people for not complying with COVID-19 safety rules. And in a time when these variants are spreading, people are worried about that.
Sure. That's Veronica Zaragovia from member station WLRN joining us from Miami. Thanks, Veronica.
Thanks to you.
The Biden administration is ramping up alliances in Asia to address what the U.S. says are deep concerns over China's repression at home and aggression abroad. The Philippines is an important part of that Asia pivot, but as NPR's Julie McCarthy reports, resetting relations is fraught.
Any reset with one of the Americans' longest-running allies in Asia is not likely to be smooth. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is accused of flagrantly trammeling the very human rights that U.S. policymakers now seek to defend. De La Salle University's Renato De Castro says Duterte's infamous anti-drug war that has killed thousands of Filipinos is just the beginning.
You have, of course, the emergence of an illiberal democracy here in the Philippines. Curtailment of press freedom, then arrest of opposition figures. The Duterte administration couldn't care less.
Washington may profoundly disagree with Duterte over human rights, but there are exigencies that loom in this long-standing and tangled relationship.
Both countries need each other.
That's analyst Murray Hebert, author of the new book, Under Beijing's Shadow. He says the U.S. wants its strategically placed partner in the Pacific to closely coordinate policy with it on military thinking.
The U.S. needs access to the Philippines so that it has easy access to the South China Sea.
And he says the Philippines needs the U.S. to help it build a stronger navy, train its troops, and figure out what China is doing. In the South China Sea, Beijing has militarized artificial islands, weaponized its own fishing fleet, and attacked trawlers from the Philippines and Vietnam. Carl Thayer, emeritus professor at the University of New South Wales, Canberra, says the U.S. would like the Philippines to help blunt China's growing influence and aggression in the region.
The starting premise is China has so militarized the South China Sea and has increased its naval presence so much that it's put U.S. predominance at risk. The whole point is Chinese hegemony in East Asia.
Thayer says the Philippine archipelago is a good place to put the U.S. military on a rotating basis to offset China's militarization. 30 years have passed since the U.S. closed its bases in the Philippines, and the legacy still ignites tension. And Duterte says his country will not be forced to take sides in any superpower rivalry. He sniffs that while the Americans focus on basing, the Chinese are doling out COVID-19 vaccines to the Philippines. But Duterte's armed forces, and much of the public, do not endorse the president's anti-American thunderings. In fact, Murray Hebert says the small countries of Southeast Asia generally support the Americans being present to balance China's assertiveness.
But don't do it too aggressively, and don't get into a war, for God's sake. Do not get into a war.
But Biden's foreign policy team must contend with a mercurial President Duterte. Just after taking office in 2016, the Philippine leader traveled to Beijing and announced his separation from decades-old ally the U.S. Hebert says China could hardly believe its luck, and Duterte went home with $24 billion in Chinese investment and loan pledges.
Now, 4 years later, virtually nothing has happened. The Chinese have built a few little bridges and worth a couple of $100 million, but none of the billions that China promised.
Until recently, Duterte carefully sidestepped any mention to Beijing of its need to comply with a landmark ruling at a Hague tribunal. It declared China's vast claim to nearly all of the South China Sea illegal. But analyst Renato De Castro says if Duterte thought years of appeasing China would moderate its behavior, he was wrong.
Just last month, China passed a Coast Guard law, which basically allows Chinese Coast Guard vessels to fire at foreign vessels in the South China Sea. So this is what he got for trying to cut a deal or appease China. So this leaves him no choice. You have to go back into the alliance.
The U.S.-Philippine alliance. But Duterte has put the Americans on notice that they will have to pay. To host U.S. soldiers under the Visiting Forces Agreement, he says the U.S. must compensate the Philippines $16 billion, 4 times what they now pay. Filipinos also want to protect Philippine sovereignty when U.S. personnel commit crimes on their soil. Carl Thayer says the change of leadership in the United States is a good opportunity for all sides to move away from entrenched positions and reengage.
And the important thing with Duterte is to listen to him. That's what he wants.
No doubt President Biden remembers Duterte's profanity-laced insults of President Barack Obama when he raised the specter of human rights abuses in the Philippines. Hebert expects the Biden team to broach the topic discreetly.
And say it quietly rather than through the news media, because that just, Duterte blows a fuse every time you do that.
But Duterte is fast becoming a lame duck, with his term expiring in just over a year. Then, analysts say, it's a whole new ball game. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
There's more encouraging news about another coronavirus vaccine today. AstraZeneca says its vaccine was 79% effective at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 and 100% effective at preventing severe disease and hospitalization in a U.S. trial involving more than 32,000 participants. And critically, there were no instances of blood clotting. Concerns about clotting had delayed the AstraZeneca rollout in the European Union. Regulators in the U.K. and the EU say there's no evidence the vaccine causes blood clots, and shots have resumed, but vaccine distribution remains an issue in Europe, and EU leaders are set to hold an online summit Thursday to discuss a possible ban on AstraZeneca vaccine exports to the UK. The BBC's Nick Beek is with us now from Brussels. And Nick, an EU official has told Reuters that doses produced at a plant in the Netherlands should go to member states first, not the UK. So how's Britain responding to that?
Well, Callum, this is one instance where there's a lot of confusion because, on the one hand, you've got these contracts that have been signed behind closed doors, so we don't know the exact details. But in terms of this plant, this is somewhere in the supply chain which the EU would dearly love to be getting supplies from. It hasn't yet been approved, so at the moment, it's not giving any vaccine material to EU countries. And to sum it up, really, the EU thinks that AstraZeneca, the British-Swedish vaccine maker, is really favouring the United Kingdom at the expense of EU countries. They reckon they're going to be getting tens of millions fewer doses than they've been promised.
What is the stakes then? I mean, you say there's tens of millions of doses here. I mean, so if the EU does block this shipment, could that set a precedent?
Well, this is it, and this is something that EU leaders are going to be talking about on Thursday and Friday. They were due to meet here in Brussels in person, but because of rising COVID rates across Europe, that'll now be a video call, as you say, and what the European Commission, so the executive arm of the European Union, has already said is that all options are on the table, and from that, they haven't ruled out the possibility of using emergency measures that haven't been used for more than 40 years, which could further tighten the export of vaccines to countries like the United Kingdom. And so potentially that could have an impact on the number of people getting the vaccine in the UK, in Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So I think we're at a sort of critical moment here because relations between the two sides aren't great. And with this sort of war of words talking about blocking shipments, it's not particularly good at a time when COVID numbers are going up.
Last thing, Nick, we know the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to speak with European leaders this week. Do you think they'll come to kind of some kind of compromise?
Interestingly, you've got some EU countries, Callum, who are concerned about this row escalating and really affecting global supply chains. The likes of the Netherlands saying that, you know, guys, we need to sort of make sure this doesn't blow up any further. We need to think about the bigger picture here. Interestingly, just in the last couple of minutes or so, we've heard that Boris Johnson spoke to Emmanuel Macron of France yesterday and also spoke to Angela Merkel of Germany. So already it seems that he's reaching out to these European leaders, trying to cool tensions a little bit, because we know in the 3 months since Brexit, there's been one spat after another. The politics has not been particularly pretty. And unfortunately, that seems to be impacting on the healthcare situation across this continent.
That's the BBC's Nick Beek in Brussels. Nick, thank you.
Good to speak to you, Callum.
Okay, here's a fact. We're wearing less makeup during this pandemic. We're realizing maybe we don't need to color our hair every 6 weeks. And beauty companies have noticed. Big brands are trying to tap into the changes in our habits, replacing long wear foundation TV ads for web messages that ask us to do something counterintuitive to the makeup industry. And that's to embrace our natural selves, like this one from Revlon.
Sometimes the boldest act is to be absolutely candid.
Our new consumption habits have also leveled the playing field, so to speak, making way for smaller beauty companies who now have our full attention through the internet.
Hey! It's Saturday Night Live!
That's Kim Roxy, founder of Lamique Beauty. She hosts Friday Night Live, a weekly virtual makeup event on Facebook where followers can participate in beauty and wellness conversation and tips from home. Lamique Beauty is based in Texas, and soon after the governor put the state into lockdown, Roxy, whose products have been sold in places like Macy's, pivoted to online only. And Kim Roxy joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. So, Kim, this pivot to stay relevant for beauty companies is almost exclusively happening online, and that's because that's where consumers are right now. You realized this before the pandemic and decided to pivot. How has this last year impacted your company?
Yeah, so Tanya, thank you for having me. I must say that when the pandemic first hit, we were like just caught because we had this huge festival plan that we were a part of. We had trade shows lined up. And when it hit, it was just like, oh, we're going to technology to use it for the products. But I still thought I was going to see people in person. So we had to immediately go right into full gear in using quizzes to be able to recommend the right products, get online like I did. And it just made me kind of go back to the basics. I took over my daughter's room. I turned on that camera like you saw on Friday Night Live. And I just started showing women how to do makeup from home because I knew at this point the best thing I could do is be a woman's friend and show her how to do makeup herself. That's how I saw myself running to her aid.
Oh, being a woman's friend. Your beauty line is vegan and organic and provides this large selection of shades for women of color. And you started at a time when there wasn't very many options. Now it seems that there are a lot more beauty brands who are stepping into this space. But how has your longstanding relationship, as you kind of refer to, with this consumer base strengthened during this time? What are your consumers telling you they want?
It's like they've been telling us that we've been a part of this. We've been in a pandemic with them. That's what we're hearing. Mm-hmm. We're actually like a part of their story on how they're making it through mental health wise, you know, giving them a time to laugh and have fun and look at beauty as a joy rather than a chore. And, you know, when it comes to what's happening right now and how we are continuing to continue that relationship with them, it's just continuing to be there for her and creating more ways. So I know that going inside of a store shopping for makeup is not the ideal thing. So now being able to live stream and shop live on our website and all these things, these are the things that we're doing to sort of continue to be there for her in a safe way.
You know, the beauty industry at large is now focusing on self-care and wellness and agency. Revlon's recent tagline is, "You don't have to wear makeup, but it helps." And Olay, we just heard, will stop skin retouching by the end of the year. A lot of them are also offering various shades and showcasing different types of women, a truer reflection of our society. It almost seems like the pandemic has forced the industry to catch up to where you are. Do you think this trend is something that we'll see continue after the pandemic is over?
Yeah, I think so, because it's really being driven by the woman and us being authentic to who we are. I have a quote that I came up with a long time ago that I still stand by today and people repeat, and it's beauty is revealed, not applied. And I've always felt that way. I've always seen it that way. And, you know, I think that where we're going now is more healthy and a place where we can really grow from and women can really be their best selves. I think that it's never been about covering up or making myself beautiful. I think it's always been about the revelation.
Well, we heard from several of our listeners about this pandemic and what it's revealed to them about their own habits and the search for products that speak to them. Let's listen.
My name is Claudia Thompson, and I live in Malden, Massachusetts. Prior to the pandemic, I used full coverage makeup, which means, you know, I'm a darker skinned woman. I'm a Black woman. So I would use concealer. I would use foundation, and then I would use blot powder. that in itself has been very different now because my home is my office. My office is my home. So I definitely have some new toners and astringents that I'm using. And then also my skin is drying out. So I'm using a lot of heavy, thicker lotions on my body as well.
Hi, my name is Liz and I'm 28 years old from Boston, Massachusetts. Once COVID began, I generally stopped buying new makeup altogether until recently. I just started trying out all Black-owned makeup brands that are targeted for Black women, such as Black Radiance. As a woman of color, I feel as if I have to go out of my way to find makeup that is made for me, nonetheless advertised towards me.
Oh, Kim, this probably sounds very familiar to you.
Yeah, it does. The height of women starting to realize that, you know, buying from Black-owned brands and being able to discover them, the pandemic actually, and also the Black Lives Matter movement really had a big part in that. The height of us coming through this pandemic still as a brand alive was that movement. We saw so much traction around consumers seeking us out, non-Black and Black, that were just like, we need to start leveling the playing field for, you know, your Black-owned brand, who a lot of times doesn't get the same marketing and appeal as other brands do, and being interested in discovering us. It's been really incredible.
That's Kim Roxy, founder of Lamique Beauty, talking with us about the changes in the beauty industry during this pandemic. Kim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanya. I love your show.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about what we're watching, listening to, or just trying to figure out, like what concert films you should watch if you miss live music, and great books to read alone or in your book club. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
There's a new crop of bills in state legislatures that aim to restrict which teams transgender girls and women can play on. And as NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports in this piece that previously aired on Weekend, All Things Considered, the National Collegiate Athletic Association plays a big role in this debate.
In February, Utah State Democratic Representative Andrew Stoddard spoke against a bill to keep transgender girls and women from playing on girls and women's sports teams. And he brought up a men's basketball game from more than 40 years ago.
1979, Salt Lake City hosted the NCAA Final Four. Michigan State played Indiana State in the championship. Magic Johnson versus Larry Bird. If this bill passes, we won't have any more moments like that.
Stoddard was afraid the NCAA would pull sporting events from Utah, and he pointed to North Carolina as an example. In 2016, that state passed a bill restricting which bathrooms transgender people could use. Because of that law, the NCAA and other sports organizations pulled events from the state. Thomas Lee worked to bring sporting events to Charlotte back then, and now he has a similar role in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Who that really hit the hardest in Charlotte and who it's going to hit here is the hospitality community. Anything and everything that is associated with visitors.
He's worried now because South Dakota's state legislature has passed a bill restricting transgender women athletes. Lee lists the NCAA events that he fears the state could lose.
Two of those are going to be D1 hockey events, which are quite large in impact, and as well as D2 wrestling and D2 women's volleyball have impact as well.
On Friday, Governor Kristi Noem sent the bill back to the legislature, saying in part that she wants to avoid a clash with the NCAA. Similar laws have been proposed in more than 20 states. Proponents believe the laws will keep girls' sports free of unfair competition. Opponents point out that overwhelmingly, the bill's backers can't show examples of transgender women's participation creating fairness issues in their own states, and that these laws may further marginalize transgender youth. The NCAA is uniquely situated in this debate in that it is an economic force and a sporting organization, one that already has a policy on transgender athletes. That 2011 policy does allow transgender athletes to participate on their gender's teams. Amy Bedient is a board member at transgender advocacy organization, the Transformation Project.
The NCAA kind of is one of the places that a lot of sporting organizations look to as far as policies, and that they have backed that up by saying, you know, you're opposing our NCAA policies, so we're pulling our tournaments out, has actually played a role.
Idaho passed the country's first transgender sports ban last year. The NCAA called that bill, quote, harmful to transgender student athletes. But the question of moving March Madness games from the state was ultimately moot because of the pandemic. That leaves many wondering if and how the NCAA might take action in other states now. Montana Republican Representative John Fuller sponsored one transgender sports bill. He says he's not worried.
Does a sovereign state of Montana going to kowtow to the what I consider the empty threats of a semi-professional athletic association? No. And with 20 other states passing similar legislation, I don't think the NCAA is going to weigh in.
More than 500 student athletes, meanwhile, have signed on to a letter asking the NCAA not to host events in states with these laws. In a statement to NPR, the NCAA said it, quote, continues to closely monitor state bills that impact transgender student athlete participation. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
We're now at the tail end of something called wave season. It's a window from January through March when aspiring travelers can typically find the best deals on cruises. But over the last year, the industry has struggled to recover from the pandemic after several outbreaks of the virus kept passengers stranded on ships and many fleets were forced to cancel their routes. Well, now the vaccine is offering some hope for the industry, but there are still challenges ahead. And for more on this, we have Taylor Dalvin. She's a reporter who covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes, thank you for being here. So we spoke with you last March when the cruise industry was just beginning to feel the ripple effects of COVID-19. It's been there in South Florida. 1 year later, how are you reflecting on the financial impacts?
The financial impacts are really devastating. Companies at this point have been a year without any onboard revenue, which has been typically their biggest source of revenue. Here in the U.S. market, the biggest market for cruising. So I think it's accurate to say it's been the biggest blow in the history of this industry. What's interesting is that there are still people buying cruises. Some companies are reporting, recently their biggest days of bookings in the history of their companies. So there definitely is pent up demand for cruising, and these companies are still taking bookings while cruises remain canceled for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. I mean, as far as the impact on the economy there, 60,000 South Floridians work in the cruise industry. 14 million Americans used to take cruises before this pandemic. When might passengers actually be able to board a cruise ship again?
It's still really too early to tell. Most cruise companies have canceled U.S. cruises through the end of May, leaving the summer open and hoping for the best. But we still are waiting on word from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about when exactly that will be able to happen. In October, the CDC put out a sort of framework that companies could follow to restart cruising. And so far, the companies are still in phase one of that framework, which is just mastering testing crew every week for COVID-19 and reporting those results to the agency. So they still have a ways to go, and there's definitely frustration on the part of the industry and cruisers who are wanting to get back to cruise ships for sort of the stall in that process.
Have they talked at all about whether they will require passengers and crew to be vaccinated?
So that issue is still up in the air. We actually had one of the biggest cruise companies in the world, Royal Caribbean Group, announced last week that they're actually going to be restarting cruises out of the Caribbean. So traditionally, most cruises leave from Florida or other U.S. ports and visit the Caribbean. Well, these cruises are going to be leaving from Caribbean countries. So they'll be launching cruises from the Bahamas and from St. Martin in June, and they're going to require everyone to be vaccinated who's above 18 years old. But that leaves, obviously, kids who won't be vaccinated. So that's sort of their compromise for now. But there's no guidance from the CDC yet on what they're going to require once cruising restarts in the U.S.
Okay. You've reported on how vulnerable some of the crew members on these ships have been. I mean, even after passengers were required to go home, thousands of crew members remained trapped at sea for months without pay. How vulnerable would you say the industry is now? Last year, you told us the risk of cruise companies going out of business was slim to none. I mean, is that still looking like it? That's the case.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up the crew members. I feel that often their stories sort of get lost in all of this. But yes, they have suffered immensely here. Some of them are deciding not to come back to the industry. Some are really anxious to return. It just depends. But these companies are in really great, pretty great financial shape, actually, surprisingly. They've all raised enough money, analysts say, to at least last another 15 months without cruises. So they have enough capital to withstand this crisis, it looks like, for the foreseeable future.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for your reporting. That's Taylor Dolvin. She's a reporter who covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald.
Thank you.
Elsewhere on the show, we heard about problems in Miami Beach, where an influx of college students on spring break has led to arrests, emergency curfews, and fears that the crowds will spark a new wave of COVID-19. But in New York City, which endured the first big wave of fatalities a year ago, many undergraduates are staying put. Fred Mogul has been talking to these students, and they have plenty to say about classmates who snagged vaccines and whether that was fair.
Shalay Ogundayan was sitting on the library steps at Columbia University, dreaming about spring break.
I'm going to get like a house with like 10 people maybe and have a good time with like a pool. I'm going to be going crazy in Miami with like a huge house, like right below downtown Miami.
But it's all just a fantasy. He and his friends have no plans.
I'm just staying here. We're just nervous about, you know, COVID and just staying in our apartment.
There have been rumors of students getting vaccinated in order to party and go on spring break, but it's impossible to know how often that's happening. Some undergrads have gotten the shot, thanks to jobs in labs or healthcare settings that make them eligible, or because of health concerns, like Shira Mikhaeli, a first-year student from the Bronx.
I put in my weight, I put in my height, and it said I was obese.
And that troubled Mikhaeli. She feels her body weight is fine and doesn't make her unhealthy. On the other hand, though, she has had some breathing problems ever since a bad case of COVID last year, and she plans to be a camp counselor this coming summer.
I think for a while I was really insecure about it. And then I think I thought about, like, listen, most of my life that's been bad for me because, you know, clothing hasn't been my size or people haven't been whatever. But this, for once in my life, it'll benefit me instead of hurting me.
So she decided to get the vaccine. When we spoke, she was scheduled to get her first shot the next day.
I mean, I'm excited to get vaccinated, but I don't think it's going to give me any freedom other people won't have. I think it's just going to be, I'll be a little bit less anxious, but I don't think it's going to change any of my behaviors.
Nearby on the steps, Eliza Abish Magder looks up from her laptop and from a paper she's writing about the novel Mrs. Dalloway. She says her roommate used a medical loophole to get a vaccine.
She's very excited to be going to parties and, how do I say this, like making up for lost time in quarantine.
And she went to Vermont to go skiing with friends. Abish Magner didn't elaborate on her roommate's qualifying condition, except to say it wasn't on the up and up.
She is calling upon something in her medical history that doesn't actually affect her day-to-day to get the vaccine.
Did that kind of bug you a little?
Oh, for sure. I just don't think it's ethical.
Downtown at New York University, they're not even getting a spring break this year, just a long weekend. But the undergraduates still have a lot of opinions about who should and shouldn't get the vaccine. Aishani Rami Reddy was chatting with a friend in Washington Square Park. She's already gotten the vaccine, thanks to her mother, who's a doctor in L.A.
It's definitely weird.
Rami Reddy had been visiting, and at her mother's medical office, there were unused doses at the end of the day.
It's such a privilege to even have that as an option that, like, it felt crazy to be like, no, I'm okay, especially when they were about to throw it out.
Her classmate, Anna Del Mahidi, also had a chance to get the vaccine when she was back home in Chicago, but she turned it down. She doesn't mind that Rami Reddy did it. But there's this other friend, a guy she thinks exaggerated his childhood asthma to get a vaccine. Now, he does live with a parent who's immunocompromised, but she still thinks he crossed an ethical line.
So part of him getting it is just, like, to make sure that, like, he's safe at home with his parents. So that's, like, a little better in my mind, but I don't know.
Bob Lazar is in his first year at Columbia. He's only met one undergrad who's been vaccinated, someone who works in a psychiatric hospital.
They were having the time of their lives, living worry-free without having to worry about catching the COVID.
That sounds pretty good to Lazar, considering his spring break plans.
I'm staying here and I'm grinding for my football season.
He's a linebacker, so that means lots of lifting weights and lots of running, and maybe a little bit of dreaming about future spring breaks on the beach. For NPR News, I'm Fred Mogul in New York.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with Kaiser Health News. And a heads up, we're working on a future story about high school seniors and this pandemic year in school. So if you're finishing up your final year in high school and preparing to graduate later this spring, we'd love to hear from you. What has the past year been like? You can go to hereandnow.org to send us your thoughts. And thanks. Five White House employees were asked to resign last week, and others have been reassigned to work remotely because they used marijuana in the past, even though the Biden administration had said it would relax longstanding White House policies so recreational marijuana use wouldn't automatically disqualify someone from being hired. Adult use of cannabis is legal in Washington, D.C. and in 15 states, and medical marijuana is legal in 36 states, but it remains illegal under federal law, and guidelines on past use for employees of the White House and other companies are not always clear. Let's bring in Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and joins us now from Washington, as he does every Monday. Hey, Derek.
Hello. Good to be here.
Glad to have you again. And I'm wondering, what does this situation with the White House firings or resignations reveal about the sort of murky rules about past marijuana use and working for the federal government?
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of de rigueur for me to answer this question with a pun, like the federal government's marijuana guidelines are hazy, or this is a lot of smoke and mirrors. I feel like that's very common among journalist representations of marijuana policy. But the bottom line truth is that this is just extremely confusing. There's federal law, there's local law, there's DC common knowledge, and then there's administration policy. So federal law says marijuana isn't legal. Local law in Washington, D.C. says that the possession of small amounts of marijuana is legal. Then there's common knowledge in D.C. among people who want to work for the federal government. And that common knowledge basically says that, look, you might be able to get hired by an incoming administration, but good luck getting a security clearance for top security jobs if you use marijuana commonly. And then finally, there's administration policy. And that's just been very confusing because the Biden team, on the one hand, has said that they have new personnel guidelines, that it might be more okay to hire people with past marijuana use. But then on the other hand, you have the firing of these five people. So this just goes to show how unbelievably confusing it is in a federalist system when federal policy and local law and local behavior are all at odds at the same time.
Yeah, it's dizzying. There's so many different components there. Let's drill down, though, on the administration policy since you mentioned it. And it starts at the top, of course. President Biden himself is not as comfortable with cannabis as many of the Democrats that he ran against in last year's primary, Derek. But, you know, his administration's employee guidelines are looser than his predecessors. So how so?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of framing this. So Biden has never been as far left or as progressive on this issue as a lot of leaders of the party. But at the same time, the administration, when it came in, said that they were going to update their personnel guidelines to make it easier to hire people who admitted to previous recreational use of marijuana. At the same time, it's just a little uncomfortable or bizarre for this White House to have a headline showing that they're firing people for marijuana use, when at the same time, you know, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, he's been doing outreach to the weed industry. Vice President Kamala Harris, she admitted to smoking pot when she was in college, I believe, like a lot of people have. I mean, Bill Clinton very famously said he partook but did not inhale, or whatever it was that he particularly said. So you have a situation.
Right, and Harris joked that she did inhale. So
right, and yeah, exactly. Harris said that she did inhale. So she said that was the point. So you have a situation where people are essentially being fired from the administration whose vice president has admitted to that very same behavior. It's just a little weird, and it goes to show how bizarre it is to have practice and federal policy at such fundamental odds.
Let's talk about the sort of broader cultural context here too, Derek, because public opinion on marijuana has evolved quite a bit in a relatively short period of time. Fill in those blanks. I mean, how have attitudes been shifting, and what do you think is behind that?
So let's look at, say, the last, you know, 30, 31 years. In 1989, 16% of Americans said that marijuana should be legal. Now it's 67. So that number has essentially, you know, it's gone up by a factor of four. We are an entirely different world from the last time that federal guidelines on marijuana were written. And as a result, I think that you see not only, you know, districts like Washington, D.C., but states like the ones that you mentioned moving on both medical use and recreational use. Things are changing on a state-by-state level, but the federal government, which has been kludgy and has been slow to move overall when it comes to passing new laws and updating regulation, has not moved to change this. And I think that that's why this story hit such a nerve, is that it was such a stark reminder that American behavioral use and American public opinion had evolved so much in the last 30 years in a period when federal law had not moved at all.
Last thing, Derek, real quick. I mean, I'm wondering whether there are still examples in the workplace where it makes sense to keep a zero tolerance policy, because we've seen public opinion shift, but not every company has done the same.
Yeah, you know, under the umbrella of a federal law that says that, you know, marijuana is not legal, companies are going to make their own decisions. And some companies, based on their culture, are going to say, we couldn't possibly care less and we're never going to ask questions about this. And then, look, there might be others that are working in high security systems and high security industries where they want to make sure to their clients and to their colleagues that the people who are hired to do really important high security jobs are not, you know, smoking pot on the regular. That is sure. Their federal right. But at the same time, we don't ask these questions about alcohol, and that has to do with a distinction that is just a matter of American history.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.